Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, an exclusive sit-down with Governor Gavin Newsom. We spoke to him on a day that he was signing a series of police reform bills in Gardena. He also signed legislation to turn over Bruce's Beach to the Bruce family. This was land in Manhattan Beach that was owned by a black family in the 1920s. Manhattan Beach took it away from them. Now they're getting that land back. He also signed a series of homeless bills this week. He also put in place a vaccine mandate for school kids when the vaccine gets full FDA approval. That was after our interview, so he sort of hinted at that but didn't get into the specifics on that while we talked to him. And he got really personal in ways he doesn't usually do about the recall, about his kids, about his dyslexia. He's got a new children's book coming out about dyslexia soon. It's the first time he'd ever talked about it. This was one of the more memorable, more interesting interviews we've done with him. And here it is, all 17 minutes of it. And hope you enjoy it. Here's Governor Newsom.
Governor Newsom, welcome back to The Issue Is. Great to see you.
Good to be back with you.
So we are here in Gardena. You just signed legislation in terms of police decertification, an emotional event.
Yeah.
And we saw some of the victims' families here.
Yeah.
What is the bottom line message you're trying to send to police officers with these series of bills?
It's just about building trust. It's about building relationships. And it's about addressing abuses. And look, if you're a police officer, the last thing you want to do is be associated with abuses. We have over 200 licenses in the state of California, where if that license is suspended in one county, you can't then turn around and open up another practice in another county. But with police officers that may have committed some misconduct, then go to another county, rinse and repeat. And so that's changed. And if it works for, you know, medical malpractice, it certainly should work for law enforcement as well.
You know, there was pushback along the way, which is why this was not the easiest bill to get done.
No.
What do you say to the critics who are concerned about due process, concerned about this process?
Well, they got due process. I mean, the due process is the cornerstone of this bill, and it was amended. And I'll be honest with you, folks on the other side were upset that there were so many substantive due process amendments, but we believe in due process. That said, we don't want it to be abused either. And so, look, it's all iteration. We were able to move something forward. 46 other states, 46 had already moved forward. So this is not a moment to spike the ball. The question is, what's wrong with California that it's not typically on leadership position or in a leadership position on these things? But look, progress was made, but it means nothing unless we apply it fairly and judiciously. And that's why we worked with law enforcement, worked with advocates, and as you suggest, worked with the victims, particularly Kenneth Ross' family that was right here a few years ago when they learned of their son's loss.
So a part of this is building trust in the African-American community is what they talked about today. Another thing you're doing today is about building trust in the African-American community, which is Bruce's Beach.
Yeah.
Continuing the process of giving that back to the family. What is the message you think that California is sending by doing that?
That we may not always get it right, but we always have the opportunity every day we wake up to right wrongs, to improve, to iterate, to become better, to become more fully expressive of our proud past and our shameful past. I mean, the origins of racism that we apply so often today in our national discourse have embers all here in California, from the internment camps for the Japanese to the Chinese Exclusion Act that emanated out of the Bay Area in the 1880s. And here we are trying to right these wrongs as it relates to systemic racism. And this is a really remarkable story, Bruce's Beach, of being able to advance a cause in a substantive, not just symbolic way of doing something right to make up. You'll never make up for those wrongs, but to do it right in a meaningful, meaningful way.
You know, California has begun the process of studying reparations.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? And what does this moment say about that?
I know there's a lot of anxiety around the reparations conversation, but I was proud to be the first governor in America to sign a reparations bill. In fact, the first task force meeting was last Friday. And no one has a very specific or prescriptive answer to what reparations means. That's why we created the task force. They have a year to engage and deliberate and then make recommendations to the legislature. The legislature will make subsequent recommendations before anything is codified. But this is, I think, important because you have the task force, which people thought was symbolic, but then you have the substance of giving back to a family, at least the great-great-grand kids and their family members, something that was taken from them for only one reason, the color of their skin. Mm-hmm.
Another big issue that you're dealing with this week, you have all these different bills, homelessness, which you've said is the biggest challenge that we've got in California. We're spending a lot of money on it, but there are critics that say we spent a lot of money before, and just throwing money at the problem isn't going to make a difference, that it's really about mentally ill, addicted people who don't want to get help, and there's not a mechanism in place to help them. What do you say to the critics on that front in terms of why is it actually going to be different this time?
Well, they're not wrong. More is not better. Better is better. And that's why we approach this completely differently. We have a new on the housing issue and a housing accountability unit, first time in the state's history. We'll actually hold local jurisdictions accountable to meeting their housing goals, doing the same with homelessness. We're requiring plans. How's that for novel? No time in previous history. We've been dumping money, but no plans were required, no measurable outcomes were required, and we're actually incentivizing outcomes with 18% bonuses. We created a new interagency council to be more deliberative in terms of regionalizing our strategies and support, but you just said something profoundly important. Mental health. Since the 1970s, 80s, we divested from behavioral health. Mm-hmm. This budget, the substantial increase in the budget, $3 billion specifically, is to reconstruct board and care, Laura's Law placement, conservatorship, housing. Because it's one thing to enforce the law, which we want to enforce, but what do you do with people besides throwing them into jail and then having this cycle of repetition, rinse, repeat, and over, nothing gets better? We now are creating unprecedented investment in that space to create the slots, the treatment beds that are necessary. Smash mouth budget. I mean, with respect to people saying, well, you made investments in the past, they were nominal. They were in the margins. I know they sound like a lot of money, but at the end of the day, they were trivial compared to what we're doing today. $12 billion, real accountability. We expect real results.
And with that kind of surplus, it's nice to be able to do things like that, right?
And I'll just remind people, California, $80 plus billion right. surplus. And I'm already working on next year's budget. And I'm looking forward to announcing that as well.
All right. Well, speaking of next year's budget, the reason you get to do next year's budget, we just got through this recall process. It's the first time I've talked to you since. What is your biggest takeaway from the recall?
The biggest takeaway, it was a zero-sum question. I mean, there was no transition time. You're out of there. You're packing. So it's an existential reality. And you live with that dark cloud. And at least for me, it was a dark cloud for over a year with people with protest signs and recall signs and petitions out there in front of your house everywhere you go. And so there's a stress associated with that. But there wasn't a distraction associated with that. And I want folks to know that. We kept our eye on the ball, and I think as a consequence, we did well on election day because people saw we actually were moving the needle on the things that mattered to them. Housing, homelessness, education, climate change, addressing these great challenges that are all pre-existing challenges to not just the recall, but even me getting elected 2.5 years ago. So my big takeaway is there's a deeper sense of urgency today than I've ever experienced in my lifetime. That people really are frustrated and angry about Washington, D.C., about City Hall, about the state capitol, about elected officials across the spectrum around institutions, and not just governmental institutions. And people are demanding real results. And if you don't show them, you can't just assert it, you got to prove it, then we're all going to be subject to subsequent recalls in the future.
You won big, and there are two different ways you could interpret those results. One, millions of people wanted to recall me, so maybe we should be conscious of that. Or two, millions more people didn't want to recall me, and we should double down on the policies. How do you read it?
I don't like a divided state. I don't like a divided nation. I really don't. I hope people, I mean, no one pays attention to what politicians say, but on election night, I try to keep my comments relatively short. I hope people go back to that. That was my heart. There was no script there. I spoke on election night about, our kids, and they're watching all this division, this consternation, the stress, the fact that you have politicians, you're seeing on the debt ceiling in Washington, D.C., that just wake up every morning with a crowbar to put in the spokes of the wheel of the other party to trip everybody up. Enough. Like, I have deep respect for people that supported the recall. Because I know they love their kids like I love my kids. I know they love their communities and their institutions, the places of worship, whatever it may be, that holds and binds us together as a community. And so I really want to find that. I'm in politics. I'm not naive. But at the same time, man, this doesn't persist. We can't thrive if we're not thriving together. We may survive, but at what cost? So that's for me when I hope. That's for me my personal takeaway, but it's hope. I'm hoping that I could rise to another level in terms of the work I do to try to bring us together.
Well, and to that point, I've always been curious about this. What do you tell your kids about the recall and about this moment in California
politics? I tell them not to hate the people. I mean, they have some of their best friends, parents, my kids' best friends, parents, supported the recall. And I'm like, don't let that get in the way of your relationship with your best friend. And don't hate his parents because they're good people. We just see the world with a different set of eyes, but at the same time, we're there together in the barbecue after the soccer game, all sharing same experiences and same expression of love and relationship. And I honestly, I tell my kids this all the time because the worst thing could happen is being a kid of a politician and you're just seeing the stress and consternation, the finger pointing. And I don't want them to have that, including Donald Trump. I made my kids many times come in. I'm not making this up, and it's interesting that I'm even sharing it. I had many conversations, as many folks know, with Donald Trump on a consistent basis. I didn't have a closed fist. I had an open hand. We disagreed across the spectrum, but I wanted to work with him. I had my kids come in and say, I'm going to talk to the president. I wanted them to hear that I can talk with civility to someone I vehemently disagree on a spectrum of issues. And I wanted them to understand that. And I'll tell you, of all the things I've done the last few years, since I've been governor, in terms of trying to deal with the challenges and stresses my kids have with their dad being a governor, I'm most proud of that because it's interestingly had an impact on them. That they talk, when they see Trump, they go, they don't say, I hate him anymore. They say, you know, I'm glad he's gone. We love President Biden. but the temperature's taken down. And that's all we need. You don't have to hate everybody. You could disagree. You don't have to hate.
So they're literally in the room while you're on the phone
with
them?
Yeah.
Interesting. And speaking of kids, we see you have a new kids book coming out talking about your dyslexia.
As of this is hot off the press this morning.
I know. Exclusive. That's how we like it here.
Exclusive.
I think that this is something a lot of people don't know about you, which I think actually just explains you more. People got to understand that. Something that I think is really an interesting aspect of your life. Can you talk for a moment about how dyslexia has shaped you and what you're trying to accomplish with this book?
One of the biggest frustrations people have with me is like, gee, he keeps talking and talking and he goes from one issue to it's because I have a difficult time even to this day reading. And when I do read, even comprehending, I have to go over what I'm reading multiple times. I have pretty severe dyslexia and it really marked a relationship with me with having to find ways to overcompensate and deal with the deep issues and stresses of self-esteem. Because you don't have much when kids are laughing at other kids because they can't read. I had to go through speech therapy for years. I found all these old files that my mom kept. And after she passed away, I found them in boxes that explained and expressed years and years and years of supplemental support that she was able to provide for me. So I did a little kids book talking about, well, a young child, proxy, I guess me, that not only had a relationship to dyslexia, but to sports, because I literally, not for baseball, not for basketball, I wouldn't have had self-esteem, and I could have been in a very different place. And so how sports created a sense of confidence that I was able to translate, ultimately try to overcome the dyslexia. And so it's a little children's book, a picture book. There are not many out there for dyslexic kids. In fact, I couldn't find one. And I have two kids with learning differences myself. And so I decided to write one, and I'm really excited it's coming out in December.
For people that might not know, the governor was a baseball star at Santa Clara, and if he hadn't blown out his arm, maybe he would be doing that instead of
this.
Well,
I don't know of a baseball star, but it got me into college. It's interesting, more important than anything else, I was going in, and no shame in this, I was quite literally going to junior college, right out of high school, until folks came knocking, and I got a very small baseball scholarship, but it got me in a four-year college, changed my life. But again, that's sports. And that's why I'm very reverential about sports. Right. Some people think, well, that's why it's the big deal. To me, it's so much more than the activities on the field. It's the activities off the field, the discipline, the teamwork.
And before we wrap up, just a COVID question, because that has been the defining issue of this last year. We're doing a lot better than other states are doing, and a lot of people give you credit for that. But is there an end in sight? I mean, what is the metric that would be used for maybe getting rid of the masks or for cutting back on some of the regulations that are in place? Is there a sort of an end in sight to some of the mask mandates and other things where we can have more normalcy?
There is, but there's a seasonality to this as well, and there's a humility to it. And we went through, this time last year, we could be having the same conversation. California's doing fairly well. Positivity rate, case rates are down. Now, you're right. We have the lowest case rates in America today consistently for the last few months. And we have among the highest vaccination rates in America. Those two things go hand in hand. If we continue to make the progress on vaccinations, yes, there's an end in sight, because I think it will put a lid on a winter surge. That said, that winter surge last year, particularly here in Southern California, was profound and pronounced. In January, we were getting mobile morgues, sending them down to Los Angeles, down to San Diego. So I'm not naive. We're not spiking the ball. That's why these vaccination efforts, we have to continue them. We can't take our eye off that ball and then move beyond and dream of regretting. I don't want to see that happen again, because we've seen it happen all across this country, around the world, over and over. Let us be mindful of what's in front of us, but also celebrate the progress.
And just lastly, how are your kids doing? Because I know they experienced COVID, and does that sort of change the way you think about COVID, having it be literally so close to home?
Well, it does, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it also made me think with a little bit more acuity and focus and intentionality around what's happening in our public schools as well. Private schools, charter schools, across the spectrum. I have two school-age kids that contracted COVID, and they just got through it. They were tested five times, positive five times throughout. Wow. And that's a very humbling experience. It's like, when is this going away? Finally got out of their system. But the impact of that brought this home in a deeper way. It wasn't just intellectual. And also mindful that, you know, it's not just the kids that are transmitting this disease. A lot of their caretakers and a lot of the staff and school employees that are doing wonderful work and trying to do their best. But even with masking, the vaccinations become really important. So yeah, that brings home a different level of focus. And interestingly, it happened the day after the recall. And it also reminded me that there are no days off when you're governor of California. There's not even a morning off. And we have to be, again, humble to the challenges.
Well, I remember being with you in 2018 on the night of your election, and then the next day was the borderline shooting, and the next day was the Woolsey fire. And
Woolsey
it's
fire.
Like every day there's something else.
Every day. But Ben and Emma's big hit is the antidote to any stress and anxiety, a wonderful picture book that's available for pre-order. All goes to charity. So I'm not just here promoting the cause of literacy and advancing an understanding of dyslexia for a good purpose.
Important cause. Governor, congrats on the book. Congrats on the recall win, and great to see you.
Good to see you. Thank
you. All right. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Governor Newsom. Also this week, we had an incredible debate between Gloria Allred and Dave Rubin. We also talked with Gloria's mentee, Paxton Smith. That is a separate edition of the Issue Is podcast. You get two for the price of one this week, which, of course, the price is always free. We hope you'll send us comments in social media. Connect with me. Tell your friends. Let other people know about this podcast. Subscribe. Rate us. We really do appreciate it. Again, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening to The Issue Is. Now go listen to our other podcasts.